It's time now for the Chapel Platform, presenting a message preached on the campus of Bob Jones University. Our speaker today is the late Gunter Salter, former Dean of College of Arts and Sciences at BJU. This message is entitled, The Christian's Obligation to Excel. The text, 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 2 and 3.
I would like to read from 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 2 and 3. It says there, Ye are our epistle written in our hearts, known and read of all men. For as much as ye are manifestly declared to be the epistle of Christ, ministered by us, written not with ink, but in fleshly tables of the heart. And from Ephesians 1, verses 11 and 12, In whom we also have obtained an inheritance, being predestinated according to the purpose of him who worketh all things after the counsel of his own will, that we should be to the praise of his glory, who first trusted Christ. Among the words of Scripture that I just read to you, I want to focus on two thoughts. First, we are the epistle of Christ, read by all men. A letter represents the writer in appearance and message. Both affect each other. A powerful, persuasive message will be nullified by flaws in presentation and appearance, while even the most elegant paper and style cannot compensate for lack of substance. The second thought is this: we are told to be something to the praise of his glory. By unmistakable implication and by express command, our obligation has thus been made clear. We are to represent the perfect Lord of heaven and earth in a manner befitting his exalted state. If, therefore, any word should come to mind to characterize the demand made on our language, behavior, and actions in view of this awesome task to be Christ's letter to the world and to be something to his glory, that word must be excellence. Having been created in the image of God, whose excellence is praised throughout the Scripture, we quite naturally have in us a desire for excellence. And that longing to attain, to achieve, to prevail, to excel is a universal human phenomenon, and it is as common to the toddler in play as it is to the businessman in his endeavor. It is a God-given, God-ordained drive that needs to be cultivated and exercised for his glory. Yet, as he has done with everything else that was proper and good, the devil took this desire as well and turned it into its opposite in order that it may no longer glorify the Creator, but appeal to the sinful nature of the creature. We need to understand that the devil never created anything. He just took something that was created and good and perverted it. Here are a few examples. God ordained that we use his name in prayer. The devil taught people to use God's name in cursing. The Bible established a proper way to own things. The devil perverted this into larceny. We know how to speak according to reality. The devil made lies out of this. God made the body so that we might eat to sustain life. The devil turned it into gluttony. We are to rejoice in achievement, yet the devil perverted it to envy and jealousy. We are commanded to talk about others in honor and love, yet the devil taught us to tear others down. God has given us sexual enjoyment within the holy bounds of matrimony, and the devil made out of it lust and fornication. And so it is with a desire for excellence. Excellence is God's standard. He looked at creation, the part and the whole, and he saw that it was good. Especially does he look for perfection in man, who uniquely in creation mirrors him in his attributes. In 2 Timothy 3:16-17, we read that Scripture is given to us that the man of God might be perfect. According to 1 Peter 1:16, God commands, Be ye holy, for I am holy. And throughout Scripture, God talks about his perfection. He urges us to strive after perfection in imitation of him. And that is a command. Not to do so is a sin. And it doesn't make any difference Whether we do not do it by design or simply by inadvertence, it is still a sin. There are two ways in which Satan perverts the God-instilled desire for excellence. One is inertia and laziness. While all of us perhaps intellectually acknowledge our obligation to excel, we may be unwilling to make the emotional commitment. We will excuse our lack of zeal with self-serving phrases such as, "It's not important that we strive all the time." And people who say that most likely don't strive even some of the time. People say, "Take it easy because life is too short. Look at all the others. They get by on much less effort. Why should I knock myself out? And does it really make that much of a difference?" Ignoring scriptural exhortation, we are often satisfied to do the minimum or slightly less than that. We are content to get by because nobody will know the difference. No, that's incorrect. God knows the difference. Secondly, Satan perverts the desire for excellence by making it completely self-serving and self-directed. We want to outdo, to outshine, to outperform others, and bask in self-glory. You go to a sports competition, and you hear, "We are number one, we are number one." People shout this for no other purpose than to humiliate other competitors in order that they themselves might wind up on top of the heap. And that attitude is demonstrated in the singular as well as in the plural. You find it among Christians as well as among non-believers. Of course, it is good and proper to compete, yet in doing so, we must not surrender to unscriptural purpose and practice and pursuit. Therefore, I want to talk today briefly about the Christian's obligation to excel in a scriptural way in all of his pursuits and actions. I want to explore first the reasons for practicing excellence, the why. Then, what are the areas of special concern, our responsibilities as the objects of excellence, the what. And finally, I want to suggest, time permitting, a number of ways that we should observe to make our practice of excellence credible and effective. That is the how. First, the why. There are three reasons that compel us to do our best at all times. First, the Bible commands in 1 Corinthians 10:31, "Whether therefore ye eat or drink, or whatsoever ye do, do all to the glory of God." And this directive is supported in Colossians 3:23, "And whatsoever ye do, do it heartily, as to the Lord, and not unto men." The Christian should need no more reasons, because these commands say it all. In doing our best, we honor God. Conversely, if we do not strive for excellence, we don't honor Him. And the opposite of honor is dishonor. Many of us know these verses. We can recite them, but all too often we don't live them. I think so often what a difference it would make in our performances if we asked ourselves in everything we did, "Does this action of mine really honor the Lord? And am I doing it primarily to honor Him?" Next time we approach a task with indifference because we were told to do it in a way that was at variance with our custom or appeared less convenient than had we done it in our own way, next time we don't give it our best shot because there's little personal credit to be gained from a particular performance, next time we feel like shirking our responsibilities for whatever reason, let us know that in doing our best, we honor the Lord. Let us strive for excellence in everything because it honors God. Secondly, we should strive for excellence because we are engaged in a worthwhile endeavor. If we are not convinced that we are engaged in some worthwhile endeavor, we need to change our outlook or our business. Things that are worth doing at all are worth doing well. Paul writes in Titus 2:7, in all things, showing thyself a pattern of good works. Now, what is a pattern? It is a model of that which is perfect, how things ought to be. And once again, as he did in 1 Corinthians 10:31, Paul makes it all-inclusive, in all things. There are no exceptions. We are amazed at the dedication of little leaguers, the hours of practice spent in preparation for games, especially the important ones. And what for? Who remembers in 2 or 3 years who won? And furthermore, what difference does it make? I think of the Olympic Games, the years of self-sacrifice preceding the supreme moment when the athlete would have died for the perfect score of 10. And for what purpose, once again? To obtain, as Paul says, the corruptible crown. The acclaim is limited, the honor temporal. But the Christian builds for eternity in the obligations that God has given him. Let us ask ourselves how much effort we put into our performance. How much was the mark of excellence on our mind as we started this new year, 1993? How well did it stay on our minds when the first obstacles and disappointments intruded upon our resolutions? Let us strive for excellence, because what we do is worthwhile. Thirdly, we should strive for excellence in order to provide that needed example for our surrounding, especially those who work for us. I've often listened to supervisors complain about their personnel. They can recount vividly and graphically the workers' lack of cooperation, their slipshod work, missed deadlines, spotty efforts, and their apparent general satisfaction with inferior performance. And then I look at the supervisors and I say, you know, I don't blame your workers very much. Why? The example just isn't there. We cannot lead with words only. We must live the example. In 1 Corinthians 11:1, Paul says, "Be ye followers of me, even so as I also am of Christ." Once again, I ask, how many of us are that sure of our impeccable walk that we can say, if you want to follow Christ, just do what I do, and in doing so, you can be sure that you are nearer to him. But that is the example that we need to set. In 1 Timothy 4:12, Paul charges, "Be thou an example of the believers, in word, in conversation, in charity, in spirit, in faith, in purity." So, to honor the Lord, participation in a worthwhile endeavor, and to set an example. These are the three reasons that obligate us to excellence. Let us now turn to the what, the areas of special concern, our responsibilities, our objects of excellence. In our considerations thus far, we have already seen that nothing we say and do lies beyond the imperative of excellence. Very often in our prayers, we identify ourselves as dedicated servants. Yet our job performances quite frequently do not harmonize with these protestations. It seems that we have difficulty applying abstract commitment to daily reality. Agreeing in theory that God deserves the best, and all things being equal, the product of Christian endeavor must excel that of secular effort, we nonetheless allow our actions to escape the control of our convictions. We permit pettiness and expediency to obscure our vision. Yet we serve the Lord of heaven. It has pleased him to bring glory to himself through our efforts. Therefore, we need to realize our importance to the success of the whole. I'm sure that occasionally, and perhaps even frequently, you hear some encouraging report about your company concerning the quality of its service and products as perceived by those outside that company. We need to realize that the programs do not run themselves. It is people, a lot of people, who, working as individuals in cooperation with each other, bring about the excellence of the whole. Does it really make that much difference what we do? Will people notice a difference? They most certainly will. The excellence of the whole is either enhanced or diminished to the extent of your contribution. You need to realize the importance of your part. Without your wholehearted commitment, the whole edifice is in danger. Sometimes I go to the supermarket and see a display of cans, very intricate display of cans. And I wonder what would happen if I would remove a strategically placed can from one of the bottom rows. The whole display would collapse onto itself. And thus it is with our contributions. There are no routine days in the life of the Christian. If you are committed, then there is no routine. Then there is only a commitment to do the best for the Lord. Realize, please, that everything the individual does is necessary for every other part of the operation in order to complete the whole. It has a rippling effect upon all of its surroundings, just like a pebble thrown into the middle of the pond gives birth to a series of self-propagating concentric circles until the whole pond, from the middle to the shore, is covered. And thus it is with our contribution at our place of service. A worker must do his best in his particular job in order that his section might make his department look good, which should strive to do its best for the division in order that the company might profit, which in turn is good for the whole industry and therefore society. The Christian has a vital function in all of this. There's no escaping that responsibility. We have considered the why and what of the Christian's obligation to excellence. Now let us deal with the how. Granted that we want to honor the Lord in what we believe is a worthwhile endeavor, and assuming that we want to do our very best to put the right example before our environment, the question still remains, how can we translate that determination into everyday activity? When students come to me for help because they're not doing well academically, they usually have been to see their advisor, who told them, work harder. Fine, the student is willing to do that. But he needs instruction, what it is to work harder. How do you work harder? Grunt as you turn the pages of a book? Use heavier construction paper? Break the pencil, what is it? And so in order that I might not be accused of the same thing, I want to suggest to you a few things that you can do in order to demonstrate that desire of excellence that I've been talking about. First, enthusiasm. Be enthusiastic about your work, because how is your coworker, the person who works for you, to get inspired about his work if you don't convey excitement? Sure, you may have done your work so long and know it so well that you think you can't muster any excitement anymore. Let me ask you, how long have you been married? Is the excitement gone? How long have you been saved? Does it bore you to talk about it? Are you planning to cancel Christmas next year because you have celebrated last year and the year before? Those matters that you really care about will hold for you greater fascination and attraction the longer you cultivate an interest in them. And thus it should be with your business. If you want your co-laborers to excel, persuade them that you have something worth getting excited about. It's hard to stay indifferent in the presence of inspiration and excitement. Enthusiasm is infectious. Paul tells us in Romans 12:11 how to tackle our tasks. Not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Paul did not advocate a laid-back approach. We need diligence, fervency in order to excel. We need type A personalities in the Lord's work. Second, faithfulness. There can be no excellence without faithfulness. Normative experience teaches that we are given to cyclical bursts of energy, desire to achieve and accomplish, followed by periods of disinterest and inertia. On January the 1st, we make New Year's resolutions to observe the rest of our lives, or at least the next 10 days. The beginning of a new year always triggers a multitude of good intentions and resolves which will be quietly laid to rest as soon as the reality of the grind sets in. But that is not the biblical approach, the line upon line and precept upon precept approach. We need to use this approach, not occasionally, not now and then, but henceforth and evermore. Respect for authority. All of us have some trouble with that, whether consciously or unconsciously. Yet the authority principle is firmly established by God, and to rebel against it openly or subtly is a carnal response to a divine imperative. Romans 13:1 exhorts us to be subject unto the higher powers. Of course, I know as well as you do that Romans 13 is mostly used to explain our obligation to government authority. But it is not limited to that. Paul speaks about the higher powers, and that is the supervisor, the manager, the boss. 1 Peter 2:18 commands, "Servants, be subject to your masters with all fear." Yet how often do we set aside specific instructions because we decided to do it our own way? How often do we undermine subtly or even more openly the authority over us? Let us determine to respect the authority over us, that those who work for us may respect ours. Mutual support, humility, are two more ways in which we can demonstrate our desire for excellence. And I will close with the last point on my list, and that is proper dress and proper language. And that is also a way to teach excellence. Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 14:40, "Let everything be done decently and in order." In the absence of any footnotes, we must conclude that proper dress and proper language are included in everything. We tend to conform inwardly to the appearance that we give outwardly. Our students, wearing coats and ties and dress shoes, will not do things that they gladly and loudly do, and wildly, I might add, when they are clad in jeans, society shirts, and sneakers. If we are careful about the details of our dress, we convey the impression that we are careful about the other areas of our lives as well. And the same thing goes for language. The sloppiness in attire and language, so prevalent today, is reflective of sloppiness of thought and lack of logical rigor, and finally, absence of firm conviction. We need to send a different signal. One personal illustration. One time, when I had one of my many operations, matter of fact, it was the first one, I had not yet met my surgeon, just a general practitioner who had made all the arrangements, and as I was lying with the don't care shot in me, the shot that makes you talk like that, rather than otherwise, I saw a face bending over me. I was expecting a Dr. Edwards, and as a face came into what I thought was focus, I said, "Are you Dr. Edwards?" And he said, "I am he." He could have said, "You got it." He could have said, "Right on, buddy." He could have said any number of things. He did not. He said, "I am he." He didn't even say, "That's me," although that would have been acceptable. But he said, "I am he." And I went to sleep happy. I said to myself, a person that is that careful with his language is also careful with his scalpel. And he was. We have discussed today the pursuit of excellence. God requires nothing less than that. Perhaps we have gained through these remarks a better understanding of our obligation. The imperative for excellence is before us, yet the response to it is highly personal.
You've heard the Chapel Platform. You may purchase a copy of this message from the campus store, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, 29614. Send a check for $6 and be sure to give the name of the speaker, Gunter Salter, the title of the message, The Christian's Obligation to Excel, and include today's date. This program has been sponsored by Bob Jones University.